From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll look at the opportunity created by a search for the next Milwaukee Public Schools superintendent. Later, spinal cord injuries present double trouble for doctors. First, the injury itself, then the body's response.
There's not a whole lot you can do about avoiding the primary injury. It is what it is. But you can do a lot about the secondary injury.
We'll mark National Poetry Month with some work by a local poet. And an exhibit features handicrafts commissioned in Wisconsin to create work during the Great Depression.
Michigan State Teachers College had a handicraft program. Indiana had a handicraft program. Missouri had a handicraft program. Ohio had handicraft programs, but none of them really had the sophistication that Milwaukee did.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. The time of transition continues in Milwaukee Public Schools. The state's largest school district is looking for a new superintendent after the announcement earlier this year that Gregory Thornton is leaving to run the public school system in Baltimore. Meanwhile, the district continues to look for ways to improve the academic performance of its students with the unique challenges of the school choice environment and resources that are already stretched thin. But some also see this transitional period as an opportunity for MPS. Earlier this week, several thought leaders in public education talked about that opportunity in Milwaukee. Paul Hill is founder of the Center for Reinventing Public Education at the University of Washington, Bothell. Michael Casserly is executive director of the Council for Great City Schools in Washington, D.C., a group comprised of leaders of large school districts around the country. We caught up with them at Marquette University Law School. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Let me ask you both a question here. We tend to look at our own district, if not in a vacuum, certainly with some blinders on in regard to other large cities. While the specific details might be different, would you imagine, are the issues facing a district like Milwaukee emblematic of a general crisis facing urban education?
I think that problems facing Milwaukee are pretty common among a lot of big cities, and the big problem is low-income and minority students are not learning what they need, and there's a definite crisis in their lives and a crisis for our country to change that. It's possible that districts could go on a long way this way. So whether it's a crisis that will cause action remains to be seen. But certainly, if we care about the stakes for those children in our country, it's a crisis.
Yeah, I haven't spent a whole lot of time recently studying the program here in the Milwaukee public schools or in the city of Milwaukee. It's pretty clear to me that the challenges that the schools in Milwaukee face are very similar to the challenges that other big cities across the country face. So in that way, it is facing many of the same issues that other big cities are facing.
Paul Hill, one of the ideas you and your organization work in is this notion of the portfolio school district model. How does that approach differ from what school districts have typically done?
The idea of a portfolio district is that it wants to get good schools any way it can. It's willing to run them in the traditional way if that will work, but if it's not working, it wants to look outside for charter operators or anybody else that can run a school. And it also is looking for all the talent in the locality, understanding that there are artists, musicians, scientists, and organizations that could actually help in the work of the schools that have been cut out. So it is the portfolio is in. Wants results, is indifferent how they get them, is just looking for the best combination, and wants to draw the talent of the community into the school district.
Is there one particular oversight model that a portfolio district works within?
Portfolio district often acts like a charter authorizer in that it tries to create a level playing field among its schools so none is failing just because it's been under-resourced, and then ask which ones are gaining, where are kids doing better than average, where are kids doing a lot worse, and then looking on the bad side, what can be done about those schools? Can a marginal improvement make a big difference for them? Are we sure that's true? Or do we have to go outside our normal experience and look for a different way of doing things?
The portfolio in Milwaukee would seem to be especially large. Traditional public schools, MPS charters, charters held by outside groups, private voucher schools. Is it possible to put someone in charge of oversight for a portfolio like that and get buy-in from all the disparate groups?
Well, it's certainly possible to put somebody in charge of it. That's happened by mayoral takeovers and other state action. In D.C., the mayor is trying to assert some responsibility for the overall situation that's almost as complex as this. But it isn't clear that any of the stakeholders are sure to like this. The district, the providers of voucher schools and charter providers are all doing fairly well in their own lanes, and there may be some kickback on that. And the issue to get the portfolio mentality into a locality is to start thinking about, are we doing the best we can for the kids? Not how do we preserve this institution or that institution or this set of contractual rights. As long as those are on the front of the table, the conflicts are too harsh to make progress. If you ask, is this the most we can do for our kids, you get a different answer.
Yeah, this is where Paul and I may disagree at least a little bit here, and I would put somewhat more emphasis on not the multiplicity of providers because I think you can have low performance in any number of different through any number of different providers. I think the issue is rests more around what it is you can do to improve the overall instructional experience and academic experience for the kids and have that experience result in better outcomes for the kids. Now, I think Paul would do that through multiple providers. But I'm not necessarily convinced that having multiple providers results in that. And I think my preference would almost be to focus on the provision of instruction more directly than to do it so indirectly by expanding the number and type of providers.
Well, and let me ask you, Michael Casterly, the organization you head, one of the things it does is bring together the superintendents from large urban school districts. MPS is in the early stages of seeking its next superintendent, and districts sometimes look at a decision like this as an opportunity to make a bold statement. What is your sense for the gravity of a decision like this? How much depends on the process of choosing a new superintendent?
Well, this is probably the most important decision that the Board of Education and the city itself and its citizenry will make. I mean, the superintendent doesn't have control over everything, nor should the superintendent have control over everything, but the superintendent is a major player in shaping the instructional program and other offerings of the and services provided by the school district and helping the board define the overall direction of the school district. So the decision that the city and its elected Board of Education faced is one of the most important that any community will face in the course of its life.
I agree. And it isn't just getting the right person. It's getting the agreement to found that person's work. So many localities just look for a person with the right attributes, and they don't have any agreement in advance about what strategy they want to pursue. And basically, a superintendent who comes in with no agreement on what his goals are and what his strategy is going to be, but has to kind of persuade the board from scratch once he's hired, is already on the way out. And if the board agrees on any strategy, and that I don't only mean the one I'd like, any strategy, and the superintendent and they jointly agree to implement it, then there's a chance for partnership. But so often boards individually have their own image of what the superintendent will do and they never agree on it, and that's the death for anybody.
Michael Casterly, what's your sense for can a superintendent come in and affect change, or does the change have to be happening and it's a reflection of who they pick as superintendent?
Well, I don't think it's really an either-or. And to Paul's point, and I think he's absolutely right about the description that he just offered, it's really important that a Board of Education be clear about its overall direction for the school district. Where is the school district going? Where does it want to be? What are the major challenges it's going to be facing, and then find themselves a superintendent who will take them there and can address the challenges that the board knows it's going to be dealing with over the next few years, rather than just hiring somebody because they have a good track record someplace else, or they have a national reputation, or something else. Finding a good fit, a good match between where the school system wants to go, where the city wants to go, and the skills of the individual they bring in to run their schools is an important part of the selection process.
Well, and as you've both mentioned, different superintendents have different powers in different districts. But do you see, are there commonalities to what the best superintendents bring to the task?
I think superintendents have to know something about instruction. They have to know how the organization works. But they're also major political figures and one of the most important public figures in town. They need to be able to gain the confidence of parents and the foundations and the business community. And in Milwaukee, I would think that you'd want a superintendent who is able to reach out to the charter and voucher operators and parents and say, you know, we're all in this together, we're all for this for the kids, and even create as much as possible voluntary collaborations if you can't do more than that.
I think the answer to this question, at least for the Milwaukee Public Schools, not for the other provider groups, is this question is really best answered by the Board of Education and its reading of where it is they want to take the school district next, what the school district needs, what the kids need in the school district to thrive and produce a productive future, and then go out and find somebody who can help get them to the place that they envision.
The situation in Milwaukee, I suspect, is similar to a lot of other large urban districts in that the city is fairly overwhelmingly Democratic politically within a state that is, if not overwhelmingly, certainly narrowly Republican. Is it too much to expect that in a big city within a state, a big state, you can get a school board, a superintendent, a teachers union, and a legislature all on the same page and pulling the oars in the same direction?
It's a lot to expect, but it's been done. Today we've had a lot of conversation about Cleveland, but there, a Democratic mayor in a completely Democratic city made common cause with a governor to get a legislative package that made it possible for the city to get off its dime. And those are all possible if all the parties think of this as about the kids and the future of the city and not about the spoil system.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think one of the great luxuries that we have in education is that so much of the field is really bipartisan. I mean, there are elements that are partisan, but the broad swath of conversations and issues that we take up have a great deal of bipartisan agreement. And when we are all trying to pull together on behalf of the kids, then I think setting partisan politics aside is a good thing and is something that education actually has an advantage on relative to other fields. But Paul's mention of Cleveland, and that's a Democratic city with a Democratic mayor, and I think most of the members of the city council are probably Democrats as well, but they have a Republican governor, and they all work together very closely in terms of fashioning what they called the Cleveland Plan and coming up with an overall game plan and blueprint that they were going to pursue to move the school system forward.
I have two recommendations. One, obviously people have to park any of their gotcha moments at the door, and they should never read blogs.
Amen.
Well, that's a perfect note to end on. Michael Casterly and Paul Hill, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Casserly is executive director of the Council of Great City Schools based in Washington, D.C. Paul Hill is founder of the Center for Reinventing Public Education based in Washington State. They were in Milwaukee this week for a forum at Marquette Law School, and we spoke with them there. We'll learn more about a promising technique in treating spinal cord injuries when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier in the week, we featured an interview about the history of Superman. For many of us of a certain age, the first Superman we remember was actor Christopher Reeve, who portrayed the Man of Steel in movies in the 1970s and 80s. He remained synonymous with the part until a horseback riding accident in 1995 left him paralyzed. From then until his death in 2004, Reeve was a public face on the need for research into ways to treat spinal cord injuries. Work going on in the Milwaukee area is contributing to one aspect of treatment that could help stabilize a spinal cord injury. They're called neuroprotective drugs. Dr. Shaker Kirpad is director of the Spinal Cord Injury Center at Frederick Hospital and a neurosurgeon at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's with us in the studio to talk more. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
What is the current state of medicine in terms of being able to treat the spinal cord in a situation that it's been impacted by a significant injury?
So when the spinal cord gets injured, typically we're talking about a blunt injury, which is what often happens when a person gets in a car crash or dives into a shallow pool or other similar trauma. It is much more rare to have a penetrating or a sharp injury by a projectile such as a bullet or a knife, although that has been known to occur somewhat on a few occasions. So when there's a blunt injury, typically it is a fragment of the bony spine or what most people would call a vertebra or a disc that breaks off from where it normally is and it impinges upon the spinal cord and causes a bruise. Normally, if a bruise were to occur in the arm or the leg, you'd have a swelling for a couple of days and then it would go away. But the spinal cord is composed of a bunch of nerves, and a bruise is very detrimental. So there is what we call a primary injury, which is caused by the direct impact. And then there's a secondary injury because the body tries to diminish the impact of the primary injury, and it sends in a bunch of agents that fight inflammation and essentially cause inflammation, which is the swelling that you see in other parts of the body. And this secondary injury is even more detrimental in the spinal cord because it further worsens the initial damage that's caused by the original trauma.
Let me just make sure I'm getting this straight. The body is trying to heal itself, but in doing that, it's actually making the situation worse?
Absolutely. So if you were to imagine the primary injury occurring over a small area, let's say size of a dime, for example, the secondary injury can now, expand that area to the size of a quarter. So it's sometimes twice, three times the size of a primary injury, and it does two things. Number one, it disrupts the nerves over a much larger area because the body's natural reaction to the primary injury. And the second thing that it does is it then kills off or makes ineffective the nerves in that larger area, so it's now much harder to reconnect those nerves. So there's not a whole lot you can do about avoiding the primary injury. It is what it is. But you can do a lot about the secondary injury, especially if you can prevent the extension of the area where the primary injury expands into. You're able to actually protect a large portion of the spinal cord that would otherwise have been irreversibly hurt.
Is the idea then to trick the body into not having that reaction or stopping that reaction in its tracks, if you will?
That's exactly right. So the whole philosophy and the idea behind interfering with the secondary injury processes in a way that's beneficial to the spinal cord is to limit the size of the secondary injury. So to trick the body, as you said, in ways in which the area of the spinal cord that's hurt can be limited to as close as possible to that dime-sized area of the primary injury.
Well, and so then putting this in terms that people can appreciate, are we talking about the difference between paralysis and not paralysis, or what are we talking about just in terms of the what's the distinction between keeping it in that small, say, dime size injury and allowing that area to be larger?
It could make a huge functional difference. So it could be the difference between complete paralysis and incomplete paralysis, which makes a large difference in terms of functional outcome. It could also mean, for example, if a person gets injured in the lower cervical spinal cord, just as an example, and they may be a quadriplegic or a quadriparetic, which means almost paralyzed but not quite, when they come to the hospital. But if you limit the area of secondary injury, you might be able to preserve or reconfigure function of the triceps muscle, which is extremely important when a paralyzed patient needs to transfer from the bed to a chair, for example. So having the ability to use their triceps makes a huge difference. So normally, if you're able to limit the size of the injury such that you can preserve the function of more muscles, it can be functionally incredibly beneficial to the patient and help them reintegrate much more normally into normal life.
Well, and so can you talk about the ways that you're starting to go after that reaction? What has changed to allow you to be able to, if not already take these next steps, be on the path to be able to take those next steps?
Well, there's a number of mediators of inflammation, and these are standard mediators that occur wherever one has a bruise in the body. The spinal cord is no exception. And the technologies that a number of entities are sponsoring involves interfering with one of these mechanisms of inflammation. So ideally, of course, it would be nice to have one drug that can blot out all inflammation. That would obviously be ideal, but you can't necessarily do that. You can only use aspirin for a fever, for example. So you use one particular molecule that you think has the most where the money is, essentially. And so in that sense, there's about two or three molecules that have passed muster in all of the initial tests, which typically involve a number of years doing experimentation in the laboratory using animals typically, and have subsequently graduated from that, gotten FDA approval, and now we're working with about two or three different agents that show promise in patients.
Well, and now presumably when we're talking about acute spinal injury, it seems like it would be critical that the treatment take place in the immediate aftermath?
Absolutely. So the window for the swelling, the secondary injury, is typically it starts between about 12 to 24 hours after the primary injury, like you would expect in a bruise elsewhere. And then there's a peak, and then it sort of dies away after about 3 or 4 days. So typically, most of the neuroprotective strategies are employed in that time frame, acutely after injury, as close to the injury as possible. So regardless of which drug you look at, most people would like to have the first dose in within 12 hours after the injury. And then the back end continues for a variable amount of time depending on what mediator of the inflammation you're going after. So it can last as much as a day and a half to 2 days after the first dose and up to a month after the first dose.
So would you envision that this would become a part of the arsenal for emergency room physicians, or this would still come after consulting with a spinal care specialist?
So currently, in terms of logistics, we're working to see how quickly we can get the first dose in, because as you can imagine, logistics is a big factor in this. But if you were to ask me to look 5 years ahead and let's say one of these treatments works in a reproducible fashion, perhaps this could be something that could be started as early as the emergency room or maybe even earlier when the patient gets discovered, you know, at the site of a traffic accident by the emergency medical technicians. Obviously, that would be ideal. We're nowhere near that first. We're still in the stage of proof of concept, but that would be the goal.
Well, and I would imagine it is difficult to set up a trial for humans in a situation like this because you have to find people who have just been injured in this way.
That's absolutely correct. So the harder part about these trials with these neuroprotective agents is, again, the logistics. In terms of – there's a lot of things that the FDA requires us to do including to prove that this patient who would be a potential enrollee in a clinical trial has a complete spinal cord injury, i.e. they're completely paralyzed, because you don't want to take a risk with an incompletely paralyzed person. It could make them worse. So number two would be to try to get all the consent process to explain what the trial is to the patient and then get them enrolled. And so obviously they have to think about it. And all of this takes time. And then we have to go through approved laboratory processes to get the drug ready and get the drug shipped to the right – to get the drug formulated in the right fashion. So logistics is the hardest part about getting the drug in at the right time.
Do you see this as playing a role? I know medicine is looking at ways of doing, I guess it's neuroregenerative therapy to either reverse paralysis or essentially help someone who has had a spinal cord injury get better. Does this play a role in stabilizing the situation for a time when 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, there might be new therapies that are discovered to help someone who has been paralyzed or otherwise injured in that way?
Absolutely. I think this would be, when you look at it in a certain way, this would be a synergistic type of approach. So essentially, a person gets an acute injury. You can't prevent the size of that, but you can reduce the amount of secondary inflammation or secondary injury. So you now use these neuroprotective agents in the acute setting, i.e. in the first few hours to days, to limit the secondary injury. So now you're left with a smaller void which you have to regenerate to fully restore function when you're eventually ready to have the regenerative therapies like stem cells and so on. So this would essentially work hand in hand with neuroregenerative therapies. This would just be a first step.
Well, and so how does the work you're doing in this area relate to the kinds of work that is being done in the realm of neurodegenerative diseases, things like ALS?
ALS, as an example, is a much more slowly degenerative condition, but it is associated with acute exacerbations, which means that the patient has stepwise reduction in the level of their function due to an inflammatory reaction. MS is another example of the same. It is conceivable that you can use neuroprotective agents, and some have been tried, where you can reduce the amount of inflammation after each of those detrimental episodes, if you will. So the way these could work in a context of a neurodegenerative disease like MS or ALS is that it could slow down the progression. And in that context would be it would be able to confer a more productive functional life for those patients.
Would you consider yourself optimistic that this work is going to have a significant difference on the spinal cord injury paradigm?
I think so. I think that the progress is going to be stepwise. It's going to be, obviously as physicians, we would like miracles sometimes more than the patients would. But I think in a systematic study like this, I think we have to be patient. However, these drugs that are being under trial right now have passed muster through a whole bunch of rigorous testing paradigms. So they do offer a significant amount of promise. And in terms of their utility 5, 10 years from now, I think they're absolutely essential, because we know the cascade of detrimental reactions that occurs after spinal cord injury, and it's almost critical to limit that zone of injury, as we call it, to as small of a zone as possible, so it's easier to rebuild the spinal cord with a future promising therapy.
Well, Dr. Shekhar Kirpad, thank you so much.
Thank you again for having me.
Dr. Shekhar Kirpad is director of the Spinal Cord Injury Center at Froedtert Hospital and a neurosurgeon at the Medical College of Wisconsin. His work includes research into the use of neuroprotective agents in treating spinal cord injuries. A quick break now, and in just a few moments, we start a weekly feature honoring National Poetry Month, which is April. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
Tension between Russia and the West continues over the future independence of Ukraine after Russia annexed the Crimea region last month. Sanctions are still in effect against leading Russian diplomats in an effort to persuade Russia not to take any further military action in the region. But Russia isn't just blowing hot air about its strategic value. Lake Effect essayist Judy Steininger says in the future it might be able to use something considerably lighter than tanks to show its might.
Could a molecule composed of one carbon atom and four hydrogen atoms ignite Armageddon? We hope not. But Mr. Vladimir Putin knows he's got what a lot of other people want, and I'm not talking about his abs. I am talking about a molecule known as methane, or nat gas, as the TV business reporters airily refer to it. Natural gas to the rest of us. Mr. Vladimir Putin is a complex man ruling a complex country. One reason he might feel so robust these days is because Russia has the world's second highest reserves of natural gas. The United States has the most. Iran is tied with Russia. Next is Canada. Aha, you're thinking. Yes, Putin controls what other countries need: energy in the form of methane. The five atoms of methane form a pyramid-shaped molecule linked by covalent bonds, meaning the carbon and hydrogens share an electron. Methane is the simplest of all hydrocarbons, a class of compounds made up solely of carbon and hydrogen. Methane is found deep under the earth, near or in petroleum reservoirs, resulting from billions of years of decaying living matter. It is also found near bogs and even belching cows, who produce roughly 18% of all greenhouse gases. From petroleum, the gas can be refined or distilled to a purified state, then piped thousands of miles for residential and commercial use. Think Russia to Germany, or the North Dakota Bakken oil fields to Louisiana, for example. We experience methane in its gaseous state. Here's why. In Milwaukee, water boils at plus 212 degrees Fahrenheit and freezes at plus 32. Methane, on the other hand, boils at a frigid minus 258.68 degrees Fahrenheit and freezes at a chilly minus 296.4 degrees. Natural methane anywhere is colorless and odorless, so suppliers add a chemical to give it that sickening sulfur smell. Methane is non-toxic but will suffocate you. It combusts like crazy and can be used to drive power plants producing electricity, heat our homes, cook meals on kitchen stoves, or even replace gasoline in cars and trucks. Now you know why Mr. Putin has a kind of ace up his sleeves. If he'd only wear a shirt. The U.S. has choices for our large resource: export or draw down supplies as we need. These are big political stakes. Grudgingly, a lot of people who oppose fracking, a rough way of injecting materials into the earth to expulse petroleum and gas, are trying to figure out which is worse, fracking or importing energy supplies from unstable locations in the world. A huge economic stake has to do with getting it overseas. An undersea pipeline isn't possible. So at a port, the methane is chilled, liquefied, and pumped into large transport ships. Getting the gas to a port isn't hard, but currently there are very few ports capable of filling and shipping fleets of tankers. However, ports are in the works in places like the Chesapeake Bay off of Maryland and in remote Kitimat, a tiny village in British Columbia. To summarize, here's how that little five-atom molecule is throwing its molecular weight around these days. The U.S. has loads of it. Russia has loads of it. Europe doesn't have any to speak of, nor does the vast country of China. Methane could make for some strange bedfellows. As Jumping Jack Flash says, it's a gas, gas, gas. The Crossfire Hurricane may yet come.
Lake Effect essayist Judy Steininger is professor emerita at the Milwaukee School of Engineering, where she has taught chemistry and literature. She currently teaches in the Great Books program. April is National Poetry Month. We're going to feature some Milwaukee area poets on Thursdays through the month, some in interview, some in verse. We start the series by sticking close to home with Lake Effect contributor Ed Makowski, who shares two poems with us today, starting with one called Seeing Gene.
Wearing headphones at the gym and trying to move beyond the sighing internal shame of arms and legs trembling under lesser weight. This, my first time lifting weights after months of being engulfed by working on a bargain foreclosure house. It's odd the way most actual work doesn't get a person in shape. It had been a disappointing week of putsy, stupid problems. Plumbers are expensive. Now I owe more money, and another contractor flaked, and I scraped the side of a borrowed van. More money I don't have. I recognized Gene and remembered him telling me about chemo the last time I saw him. Uncertain I could imbibe any more average tragedy, I nearly diverted eye contact. But instead, we both smiled and took off our music. Gene said he got a job with the county and works as a bouncer on weekends. They've moved to a tree-lined street. I have neighbors with poodles. Can you believe that, Ed? A freaking poodle. And his wife, he's married now, works as a nurse, and they're going to Cancun next week. Cancun, huh? I asked. Yeah, he said. Who'd have thought? Me, healthy and married and flying to the tropics for a paid vacation. You just gotta keep moving forward, Ed, even when it don't make sense. Sometimes you just gotta say screw it and stay alive long enough to get back to living. It's great to see you, bro. I was lucky to see him, too. This poem's called Name. Arriving at a lunch counter, a waitress was discussing names with another patron. I listened for a while, trying to figure out the direction. Then, during one of those pauses when a smile invites you, I asked if they were discussing pet names or human names. The waitress explained she was due in the end of spring. I said that was great and added some of my favorites. Giles, Archer, August, Terry, Simone, Ami. That was last fall, and the waitress still weighs about 115 pounds. I've never asked, the way you don't ask some things. But I'll always wonder about the name.
Milwaukee poet Ed Makowski reading Name, and before that, Seeing Gene, as we mark National Poetry Month on Thursdays through April. One last break, and then the Museum of Wisconsin Art takes a look back at a tough time in American history with a remarkable project that sprung up during the Great Depression. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The Great Depression was among America's darkest hours. The 1930s were a time of desperate economic circumstances for people from all walks of life. In Milwaukee, more than 40% of wage earners lost their jobs between 1929 and 1933. But it was during that time that the federal government found some remarkable ways to put people to work, one of them right here in southeastern Wisconsin. The Milwaukee Handicraft Project used the vision of women artists and employed thousands of people in making wooden and cloth articles. That project is seeing new life in an exhibit that recently opened at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. Graham Reed is director of collections there, and Dr. Charles Weisbren is the collector of many of the objects on exhibit. Reed tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North more about the Depression-era project itself.
The concept that you would have a relief program that employed people, predominantly women, who were essentially deemed almost unemployable, to bring them into a program that made such remarkable things based on aesthetics, design and education, and that these products would be dispersed not just within the city or within the state, but actually nationally to taxpayer-supported institutions, schools, libraries, hospitals, orphanages, that really fulfilled a need, not just for the people who received these products, but they were absolutely essential for the people who made the products as well, because these products really gave these people a sense of purpose, a sense of pride. It gave them ownership of something. It also gave them a paycheck.
Well, it sounds like it follows the WPA model, where you're bringing people in, you are creating things for basically an unemployed workforce. But as you say, what makes this unique is that this was specifically aimed toward women, and it was integrated. And it was integrated in 1935 in Milwaukee when that just wasn't done.
Yeah, I mean, they went to Elsa Ulbricht, who was really the champion and leader of the whole project. And they actually asked her, would you take African-American black workers? And she said, because a lot of the other programs wouldn't. And she said, yes. 250 showed up on the first day in November 1935. By the end of the week, there was about 900 people coming to this program because they had heard that there were jobs available for them.
Well, Charles, how did you first learn about this and then become a collector of these objects?
Basically, I was interested in the WPA and the Federal Art Project as a whole, because I thought they really developed wonderful works of art. And again, most people are familiar with the big murals that they did in post offices and a lot of the paintings and the prints. And I think really what drew me to the WPA works is I felt it was really true American art. So here were artists who weren't really constrained by what would sell. They could really do what they wanted to do, and they were paid a weekly stipend for creating works of art. So I don't think they were really under the constraints that a lot of other artists had to do in that they were trying to sell works. Again, the works they produced really showed the American scene and really showed what they were feeling during these real hard times. And I was sort of drawn to that look. And when I moved from New York to Milwaukee, I learned about the Milwaukee Handicraft Program. And again, I think what's so amazing about the Milwaukee Handicraft Program is when they first started, you know, the initial idea was for them to cut out wallpaper objects and make scrapbooks for inmates in the county institutions. And Elsa Albright said, no, that would not be of interest to me at all. And so instead of just doing busy work, they really created wonderful works of art. That's what I liked about it.
Let's talk about Elsa. Who was she and why was she the person that the WPA went to say, can you start this project?
They went to the Milwaukee Teachers College and had this idea of cutting out the wallpaper. And Elsa Albright was the fine arts director at what was really become UWM now. And so they went to her because she was going to develop this handicraft project. And they dealt with handicrafts because they felt this is what unemployed women could do. You know, they could do, they could do scrapbooks.
And they could stitch something.
They were just going to cut out stuff. And she said, no, that's not what she was interested in at all. And she declined. And then when they came back to her, she said, okay, well, I want to hire people who I've taught. And they could be the program directors and they could organize the women workers to do, fine works of art.
When Elsa kind of decided to take this project on, she looked around for qualified, experienced designers and craftsmen, but most of them had jobs or were already on other programs. And so she actually ended up going to her students, many of whom who could not find jobs during the middle of the Depression, and they became the designer foremen. So this was not Elsa and a whole group of, highly qualified instructors and craftsmen who actually did this program. These were basically young people in their early mid-20s who were designing these objects, making the prototypes, and then basically teaching the workforce how to make them.
So those 900 people showed up at the end of like the second day that this was announced. Did they come with any skills at all? I mean, other than, say, basic sewing skills to be able to mend clothing?
They really didn't even have basic sewing skills. Okay. They were considered really unskilled.
Some of these women didn't know how to what end of a pair of scissors to hold. They were actually a very nervous and scared group of women who showed up because they didn't really know. They were just sent to the address and they showed up and they were kind of, we don't know what we're going to do. We don't know what we haven't had a job for years, maybe not had a job ever. And so there was a great deal of apprehension on that first couple of
days. So what were the first things that ELSA had them do then?
See, it was interesting. For instance, the way it really set up is, for instance, ELSA for the DAL program, she took a prize student, Mary Jane Kellogg, who was still in school, and made her head of the doll-making program. So her job was really to set up these women to you know, help create the dolls. But it wasn't just throwing them in. She went and got a very, very known professional doll maker to sort of help design the doll. And so they'd had the design, and then they taught the students how to either, you know, cut fabric for the clothing or to press fabric into to make the head the mold for the dolls. They taught them everything. They did other projects. You know, they did dolls, they did toys, they did costumes, they did bookbinding, they did textile printing, all having as a head of one of the departments, one of the prize students or recently graduated students sort of helped design and help train these workers. All these departments had a real trained, sophisticated, educated person sort of leading the trips.
How long did it take to get this up and running as a business?
I mean, it started in November 35, and really by 1936 they were up and running. And, you know, the textile printing was one of the first things, but then they moved into theatre costumes, furniture. They did a lot of – in fact, they actually almost got to the point where they were doing an interior design service where they would do desks and tables and chairs and wall hangings and rugs. So for schools, universities, hospitals, if they wanted to refurbish their offices and common areas, they would – and it was a great deal because basically the institution only paid the cost of materials because the labor costs were basically paid through the federal.
Okay, so the WPA paid
that. Basically,
okay.
Yeah, the WPA paid that, but basically the purchasing institution paid the cost of materials, which in most cases was literally cents.
Less.
There's only a few – furniture aside – but most of the other things, I mean, the most expensive doll was, what, $2.25?
$2.25,
yeah.
Now, interesting enough, though, these were really not available to the general public.
Okay.
So they had to be tax-supported institutions. So let's say a nursery school teacher would say, hey, it would be nice to have something in my classroom. And so the school would go pay the $2.25, which is also an interesting point is who owns all this stuff. And that's become a much, much bigger issue, obviously, with the fine arts, with the prints and the oil paintings and things like that. And that – the government still says they own it and it's – you know, they don't really want that bought and sold on the private market. The handicraft items, the federal government doesn't really go after and doesn't really claim ownership, although in reality – it probably is still owned by the individual schools and institutions.
I was going to say technically whoever purchased it, you know, if they're still in existence, you know.
And many of them are not. The biggest take-home message to the whole Milwaukee Handicraft Project is the quality of work. And if you come to see the exhibit, you're going to see just wonderful wall hangings, wonderful block prints, wonderful dolls. You know, just the work is just fantastic. I know in the doll program, Helen Clark was in charge of the doll program, and she really insisted on quality work. So the stitching of the clothing had to be perfect. Otherwise, it wasn't accepted. Everything had to be perfect. They ran a very tight ship.
And I was looking at some of those. Graham pulled out a couple for me when I was up last week. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at the stitching and I was looking at the buttonholes that were made and everything. And it's beautiful, beautiful
yes.
work.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I was reading an interview, a transcription of an interview with Elsa Olbricht, and apparently some of the ladies who worked on the program who were making the doll clothes actually basically took the patterns, took them home, and then upscaled them to make clothes for their own children. So it's kind of a nice reversal. It's not like we're taking adult clothes and shrinking them down to doll size. They were taking doll size clothes and enlarging them to fit their children because the designs were so good.
Mm-hmm.
And then you how to make them. They knew how these things went together because they'd basically made miniature versions of them.
Are there still any women living in Milwaukee that we know of that were part of this program?
About 10 years ago, I think at the public library, they had some of the people who designed the toys were alive and talked about it. I don't know if anyone is still alive.
I doubt it.
They would be pretty old at this point.
One of the things
yeah.
that just as a consequence of the people who got employed by the Handicraft Project, it tended to skew fairly old right from the get-go. So these were women in their 40s, 50s, even 60s or older.
But there must be relatives and people who are descended from some of these women.
Yes. I knew a lady for many years, Betty Sullivan, whose mom worked on the program. And they had pictures of her playing with the dolls. And she was very active in collecting the WPA dolls and the programs themselves. And I think she donated all her stuff to the museum here in Milwaukee. And so she had a connection because her mom was mm-hmm. very active in it. And I know that Henry Sinodal was an artist a lot with the program, and someone I know from New York has been in contact with his son and talked about the program. So he lives here in Milwaukee as well.
So obviously this program was well known at the time in Milwaukee.
It was known nationally. It was known as the project that made Milwaukee famous. It was a kind of play on the whole beer thing. But it was known as the project that made Milwaukee famous.
And so did other cities take it as a model to use for?
I think they tried, but nobody came close to replicating
it. No one did come close. I mean, Michigan State Teachers College had a handicraft program. Indiana had a handicraft program. Missouri had a handicraft program. Ohio had handicraft programs. But none of them really had the sophistication that Milwaukee did. There was more just as far as the doll programs, they made foreign dolls to sort of show the dresses of foreign countries. Nothing with the originality and the wonderful workmanship that Milwaukee had.
I don't think you can ever underestimate the importance of Else Obrecht. I mean, she really just drove this thing, her passion, her commitment to it. I mean, I don't think this thing would have been anywhere near as successful without Elsa. I mean, she fought in 1942-43 as war production was taking over and the program was essentially becoming redundant. I mean, she fought to keep this thing going. And they just kind of said, look, we can't keep this thing going. We've got war production and, this is not – this program is really not needed anymore.
So, Charles, I'm going to put you on the spot for a moment. I know you collect – a lot of this and a lot of what is on view here is from your collection. Do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? I like the wall hangings the best. I just think the workmanship is wonderful. I kid aside, I have a large doll collection and my children are absolutely aghast that I have dolls. And they don't understand it. I think the dolls are wonderful though, I always have to – after I say that, I have to say, I coach basketball and I play tennis and I'm –
But I have dolls.
But I have dolls. So
what's neat is in the exhibition, not only are we going to have quite a number of the dolls, but we actually have one of the original molds that the head was made from and the original paper pattern that the doll, the 22-inch doll, which was kind of the benchmark, it was kind of the ultimate doll that was made by the program. We have a set of the paper patterns and we have a head mold and then we'll have kind of quote-unquote a naked doll. So if there's any doll aficionados who are listening, you will really be able to see how these things were kind of made.
And the design that went into
them. And the design
them.
Of how yeah. they were constructed, yeah.
The toys were wonderful too. So they had boy toys as well as girl toys.
Yeah.
The toys are fantastic.
Oh, too, yeah. I saw some of the little trains and some of the trucks.
The toys
and
are fantastic.
Yeah.
And again, they have a wonderful look and the toys are absolutely fantastic as well.
Well, Charles and Graham, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about the exhibition and for your enthusiasm for bringing it to light. Because like I said, this is something I knew nothing about, and I am thrilled to know what happened right here.
Thank you.
Well, thanks
much.
For having us.
Thanks, Bonnie.
The exhibit, Handmade for Hard Times, the Milwaukee Handicraft Project, runs at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend through June 15th. Graham Reed is Director of Collections at the museum. Charles Weisbrenn is a collector of MHP objects and loaned many of them to the museum for the exhibit. They spoke with Bonnie North. That's all for the Thursday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be able to join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.